You're listening to the Fusion Patrol Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Fusion Patrol. I'm Eugene.
I'm Ben.
And tonight we're going to be talking to you about Doomwatch, Episode 5, Project Sahara. Welcome back, Ben.
I know Thank you.
People have been clamoring and saying, where is Ben?
So Ben was out in the Bahamas.
All right, Ben has an excuse that we'll let him get by with. just this once. So, Doomwatch, 1970, as you may recall, British TV show. Many of them are missing. This happens to be one of the ones that is not missing. What did you think of this episode?
It was not a very sci-fi type episode. It was revisiting this theme about the human condition in terms of human judgment versus computer judgment. So I mean, it's an old theme. Some would say maybe a tired theme. But they had their own particular angle to go with it. Not, like I said, not very sci-fi as we've seen with past episodes, but enjoyable nonetheless.
Interesting, because I thought, I mean, when I watched this episode, it's not exactly a thriller. And it hasn't got a terribly exciting plot. But somehow, when I look at this, and I say, this is 1970 in Britain. I am so impressed by this story. Not from the angle of talking about should we be using human judgment versus computer judgment. I thought that was the secondary aspect of the story. It's really about the theme of being all-encompassingly, all your activity, all your credit, and all your information put into a computer that the government is actively working on setting up, combining all the information that's out there in little bits of computers and banking transactions and other places. And I just feel like that is so far ahead of its time compared to any other show. I mean, I cannot recall any science fiction show that really sounded the alarm about that particular danger of the future. And being an IT professional, as I am, it seems so, it resonates so much with the world that we have now. Not, you know, not necessarily the computers making the judgments just yet, but all the information. I mean, look at Google. I mean, for crying out loud, look at, if you knew what Google knew about you, you'd probably cause,
I'd probably throw my computer away and run to the hills.
I think so. And you know, they're not making the kinds of decisions that they are in this particular episode. They're making other decisions. They're making lucrative commercial decisions, trying to get you to buy things as opposed to determining whether you're a security risk or a traitor to your country or things like that. But you know, if Google's doing it, so is the NSA.
I understand what you're saying about the idea of all this information that has been absorbed and stored in computer memory banks. I was very much cognizant of that. I more focused on the decisions that were being made, because they were not being made by man. They were being made by computer. And that was the one thing that I found to be most shocking. I caught the forward thinking of the show with this notion that all our actions, everything we possibly do, has been distilled down into bits of memory data. That was not lost on me. I was more disturbed with the concept of letting the computer make the decision regarding your own future.
And the, you know, there was a sequence that didn't have to do with the Doomwatch guys, but where Quist was introduced to the computer and he overhears what's going on, and it's talking about this guy and his personal life and his debts and a variety of things that they have culled together, and you know, they're pointing it out. It's like, here he is, he's a blackmail risk, and that is a very real situation. I mean, look at look at Hoover. he would have been a blackmail risk if some of his habits.
Oh, some of his little personal tastes had been.
I mean, you know what types of persecution that they would do to people who wanted to be in the FBI, who may have had certain different sexual orientations? I mean, absolutely, positively not, because that's strictly, you put somebody in a trusted position who's a blackmail risk, you can't do it. I mean,
right.
The reasons behind it are wrong, but the conclusion is correct. If a person can be blackmailed with something, whether that's right or wrong, but they feel it's wrong, or they feel that they need to feel that it's wrong, you know, that is a valid concern for a security organization.
But then again, it, like I said, my concern here was who was in charge of making the decisions.
Well, was it, you know, you,
was it the human?
That's
or a, is it the computer?
It, you know, I did, so the computers.
I mean, they simply asked the computer to make the decision for them.
Did
in
they
the
make
show,
the computer, and, or did the computer simply put out the readout and say, you know, here, this guy, we got a problem?
Well, the computer did do that, but what happened is that here you've got these, again, you have these humans who are, I'm assuming they're part of the ministry or they're part of the government.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, and they blindly accept the notion that the computer is infallible.
So here's the thing. You'd have to. And the reason that you'd have to is because here's what happens. The computer spits out and says, this guy's a potential security risk. And you are the person who reads that, and you have to act upon it. Now, if you don't act upon it, and it turns out that the computer is right, you're up the creek without a paddle. And if you do act on it, and it turns out to be false, it's the computer's fault. This is the same situation that we have with liability, with, you know, people are constantly doing the wrong thing because they are put in the position of abrogating responsibility to somebody else or to something else so that they cannot be held personally accountable for it. And so, yeah, in a way, the computer is making the decision, but the people who are supposed to be using that as information to make a decision are abrogating that responsibility.
Yes.
Because of fear of liability or blame or blah. But let's just kind of talk about the episodes. Talk about the forward-reaching part of this episode. Then let's talk about the backwards-reaching parts of this episode, which starts off with our team working on information about Project Sahara, which is a new military defoliant, essentially. And they have their concerns about it. And they have a Dr. Stella Robinson in, who is, as you may be able to guess by the name, a woman. And she's the botanist working with them on this project. And the backwards part that I want to mention up right at the front is what any... This is even worse than previous episodes with regards to sexism.
Some of the comments were
outrageous, like, oh, well, two women in an office, that can't ever work out. I mean, holy cow. I can't imagine that kind of dialogue.
Well, again, but as you pointed out, this is 1970s, and this isn't
I
a
couldn't
show.
Play
it's
it not, 1970 well, in this country. I well, couldn't it, believe
no,
it.
No, but it's not like UFO, where... It was filmed in the 60s, but is trying to project a notion of what the 80s will be. This is a show that was filmed in the 70s and is established culturally as taking place in the 70s. So they're not They don't have any excuses to make here. I mean, they are blatantly honest in regards to, well, this is what society is. This is how we refer to people. Doesn't make it right.
Here's my question.
No.
Here's my question. In a program like Doomwatch, which is ostensibly to show us what's wrong in the world. I mean, that's what Doomwatch is all about, is to, you know, here's what goes wrong, here's what goes wrong. So it is taking a moral preachy position, if you will. So were they trying to show us how awful women are treated, or was that unconscious reflection of reality?
I think it was an unconscious reflection of reality.
I think you're right. I think it was. I do, but I just wonder if, I mean, it was so bad in places in this episode.
But that's the way it really was. I mean, you look at any kind. You can,
oh, people look at, say that.
Oh, don't even. I mean, you look at anything that's going on in society today, and you can, you know, I don't want to get too far off topic, but just
on
look
this show.
Really. All you have to do is look at what some of the extreme political and social right. You know, and I say, and I don't mean right as incorrect, but just super right-leaning, some of the
Nazis.
Issues that,
oops,
that they claim to be of some kind of moral value. You know, they think that they're right, but anybody who's got, you know, several brain cells working would take a look and think, oh, my God, you're a racist, you're a bigot, or you're a misogynist, or whatever it is. I mean, anybody with common sense would take a look at that. You know, like we would like look at that and say, "Oh my God, that's horrible! How can he even say that?" Well, in their point of view, they're right. It's the same thing here, except, you know, culturally it was more. I don't want to say more accepted. It was just, that's just the way it was. That you would talk about women in that particular tone. I mean, sexism was a very real thing back in that time. Shocking? Yes.
Well,
inappropriate? Well, by our standards, most definitely.
I think we'll come back to that a little bit later too, because there's another aspect of this that I want to mention too, but let's kind of plod through the episode a little bit. The crux of the episode is that this Project Sahara is looking bad. It's looking like it's far more dangerous than the defoliant weapon that the military hopes it to be. Their hope is that you spray it over some bad guys, and it kills their plants immediately, and it renders their earth sterile for about 2 years, during which time, if you're fighting against them, they have to surrender because they're starving. And a couple years later, their plants grow back, everybody's happy, life's all good. The concern here is that the soil will not grow back in 2 years, that it is far worse and it's far more dangerous. And that's where it looks like the Doomwatch team is going. I don't think they ever really get. They never really make that determination at the end. They're close, but they haven't made that determination.
Because that's mainly not the focus of the plot.
No, it isn't. No, it isn't the focus of the plot. But it's what precipitates it. In other words, this is such an important military defense project that the ministry steps up security with their new surveillance technique or their new computer. Monitoring. Well, it's not really surveillance, but technique. And they make a recommendation that Wren and Dr. Robinson need to be suspended immediately for no given reasons other than security concerns. Toby Wren, does not take this well. And this is another interesting piece of it. He really goes on a bender.
Oh, doesn't he, though? Yeah.
And
he goes on a huge drinking binge.
And again, the drunkenness of his character is portrayed so differently than a drunk in an American television in the 70s or even in the 60s. I'm not even sure how to describe it. It's just different. I wouldn't say it felt natural.
I just took it to TV writing.
Wasn't quite the pantomime drunk that you would get, frequently get in American television. But it wasn't really, I don't know. Anyway, he is quite drunk, and he meets this friendly chap who is also in the civil service, and they go off and have a bunch of drinks together. But not before he has a chat with Dr. Robinson after he's been thoroughly sloshed. And we come back to one of the themes that we discussed before, and that is this really wrong notion, I think, that scientists are clinical and unemotional. Because what does he do? He says, let's do this scientifically. Go to bed with me. Yeah, you want to make me feel better? Go to bed with me. There it is. Straight out. No nonsense. The scientific way. And she turns him down. And he, you know, goes on, well, what are you saving it for? They're obviously on some sort of crusade, because that theme has come up before in the rat episode with the woman scientist in that one who created the rats and you know uses Ridge like Ridge uses her. So what it occurs to me though is that this might actually be accurate, because intelligent sciencey guy tried using that line to pick up women.
He's not going to have any success.
And that could explain why stupid people breed faster than smart people.
Make a good argument there.
I think Doomwatch may have caught on to that one long before the movie Idiocracy. Which if you haven't seen it, you should see it. Just a recommendation from me.
What I was going to say is that, I'm 50 years old, but at the time that this show was being made, I mean, I wasn't old enough to be, how can I put this delicately, active in that kind of lifestyle. So, especially in the areas of drinking, I wasn't 18. So I couldn't go out to bars or take in any of that kind
Being
of activity.
Nine and all, you wouldn't be.
No, exactly. I mean, 9 years old. Yeah. So it kind of removes me in terms of what was the world like. How did people behave? So I look at this now, and I think, well, I kind of have to just accept it at face value. As just being, well, this is what 1970s was like. I can't comment on it because even though that I was there, I was too young. So
I have to comment on it, looking at it from trying to compare that to, I mean, we are comparing television, which is not necessarily always an accurate reflection of the world. I compare it to other television that we had in the United States, and it just isn't. I mean, it just isn't. Not the same. I went through the primetime listing for 1970 just to see if there were any shows that even remotely would make me think that the world was like this. And I think our view was far more sterilized.
Oh, absolutely. I would agree with that. You know, there was this incredible homogenization of the kind of shows that were being put out. You know, this, I don't want to get onto that. I mean, we've kind of had that conversation in past episodes anyway. But I think you're right. We never really saw anything that they didn't. I mean, when you think that All in the Family is the most controversial show in terms of sitcoms ever to come on TV in that era, I mean, and even that by today's standards, you kind of look at it and say, eh. Okay.
Ronan Martin's Laugh-In.
True.
Same year.
True. I would agree with that. But even then, there was a lot of masking and a lot of disguising of the issues that they were trying to get across via the humor. So it would color those subjects to such a point where, in some cases, it would cease to recognize anything that was based in reality.
So,
not like the way Doomwatch did it.
Yeah. So Toby's got a drink problem that we had not previously been made aware of, but he's got a drink problem, and he's easily identifiable as a scientist because he carries a slide rule in his pocket. I was so happy to see that slide rule. You don't see slide rules anymore. I used to have – my dad got me one of those when I was in high school because he was too cheap to get me a calculator when they first came out. Just like I wanted a calculator, which were literally four function, you know, plus, minus, subtract, and the other one. And divide.
Multiply, divide.
Yeah. And he got me this slide rule. And, you know, because this is what real engineers use. And he was right. It was the coolest toy I ever had. I did all sorts of math problems that I had not the slightest use for whatsoever with it. Anyhow, anyway, last known picture of a slide rule I've ever seen in television. Meanwhile, Mr. Keeble? Keeping. Commander Keeping. He is in charge of that computer division that's using this, and he's a former cop and investigator. And he is pursuing his investigation pending during their suspension. And, you know, he's been trying to probe Wren while he's drunk, and he also goes after Professor Robinson, and we do find out who she's been keeping it for, as Toby Wren put it when he was rejected. She's having an affair with a married man. And turns out to be, well, gosh, he's a married man. He's being blackmailed by enemy agents to steal Project Sahara from her. So it's kind of an interesting dynamic. I mean, they're having an affair, and so he's being blackmailed into using that affair to
steal classified documents.
And they wouldn't have been in that situation if they hadn't been having the affair in the first place. So it's not like he started the affair so that he could steal the documents. It's a little opportunistic there. And of course, she has to keep the affair completely secret too, because of course, she'd be a security risk if she was having an affair with a married man. So, and in fact, even though, and this is kind of where we get into that again, double standard. I mean, I'm not going to say she's blameless in this situation. Obviously, the married man is the guy who's breaking his vows, contractual or otherwise, with his wife, and she is not. And that's look back on it. But in those days, she would have been...
She was the homewrecker.
She was the homewrecker, and therefore, once again, we're talking about these ancient attitudes towards women that they had. It wouldn't work that way with a guy homewrecking a woman either. It just didn't work that way. Uh-huh. And so again, I mean, that's kind of one of the reasons why I feel maybe that they really were exploring perhaps this side of sexual inequality in this episode, they seem to keep coming back to these things that really only would have happened to her if she were a woman in this situation. But of course, the other thing is, she's half Syrian. And the Syrians,
right,
and her father was killed by maybe those Israelis. Her father was English. And so the reason that she's a security risk is because she may want to destroy the Israelis. That she may...
For killing her father. Because he was actually... He was English, but he was also an Arab sympathizer.
Right. or a scholar, Arab scholar at least. And so that's what the computer has coughed up and said, you know, here's why you're a security risk. You're probably an Arab sympathizer. And it was an interesting line when Quist found that out, that he said, well, it makes pleasant change from the communists. I think also this is probably the first time in a show I've ever seen anyone look at the Arabs as a threat. You know, in the 70s, it was, in here, it was 100% always Soviet bloc countries.
Oh, yeah, it was always, you know, America versus the commie kind of attitude.
So, again, kind of a different take on things that we didn't necessarily see in this country. And of course, so Quist is, you know, constantly he's 100% behind his people. You know, they couldn't possibly be, they had their security clearance. You aren't presenting any evidence as to why that they should be considered a security risk, and he keeps digging and ultimately puts it on the line with, I think it's the minister. You know, that Becker, I find it hard. I couldn't tell whether he's supposed to be the minister in this episode or whether he's supposed to be security guy in a different division or something. But, you know, I will call the prime minister and I will close down Doomwatch if you don't tell me where you got this information. And that threat has weight because he backs down and he shows him the computer and he tells him all about how fantastic it is. And, you know, we've all known this is going this way and it's going to happen. And we're using these tools and they're telling us these things. And Quist is appalled at the whole notion, as our hero would want to be, of course, because that's his job, to be appalled by all technology and progress. But
I found the computer, obviously I found the computer technology to be, in terms of the data that was input, to be somewhat unbelievable. It seemed a little far-fetched to me, just purely from a technological standpoint, that working at a very primitive CRT, that you could just type in a couple of things in a matter of under a minute, and then it could distill all of that information and come up with this apparently what the ministry viewed as an infallible conclusion regarding a person's character. As to whether they'd be a security risk or not.
Oh,
from a technological standpoint, I thought that was a little far-fetched.
I think that, and I'm not defending their technology by any stretch of the imagination, but we're not talking real-time computing there. We are talking about they had already run these files, that they were running these files, you know, and consolidating this information and in the background all the time updating these files. And all they were doing at the CRT was just calling up the current state of information.
It didn't feel that way to me. It looked like they're actually inputting new data. That's what I
Well, the girl behind the counter was a little overambitious with the keys. But I think she was just like, yeah, I think she was just, you know, typing in Quist, Quentin, section 5158, and then it was bringing up that file kind of thing. But which, by the way, they also showed the files for Quist and Ridge, both of whom were considered needing security monitoring. Quist needed constant monitoring, and Ridge needed periodic monitoring.
Interesting.
And then we never did see Wrens when they started running it. So, and then we came up with the information about the security risk. And you're right; they said, you know, the computer must be infallible. And so, what happens is the guy who's having the affair with Dr. Robinson steals her files on Project Sahara, which she rather carelessly left out.
She just leaves just exposed out in the open.
Yeah, but, you know, in retrospect, she did pull it out intentionally for him to see.
Right.
And
but I just
because that was just one of, she figured out he was trying
right,
to steal.
Yeah, we do discover later that she's I wouldn't say dummy the documents, but she leaves something of I don't know, red herring.
Yeah. So anyway, he's killed because he turns it over, and the Arabs don't particularly like that, and so they kill him. And she's called in to identify the body. Quist is there. And we're basically, so what we're presented is this. We have met a scientist who is half English and is half Syrian. She may or may not have Arab sympathies, but she vehemently states that she's apolitical, that she does not have it in for the Arabs, that she is completely loyal, that she would never discuss her work, that she, you know, she is not a security risk in any way, shape, or form. She intentionally found out that the man she was in love with, well, she found out that he was trying to steal something from her, and she set a trap for him and made sure that he did not get the secret plans, which shows that her loyalty was indeed where it belonged, and he paid the price for that. And, of course, when that all comes to the conclusion, comes out of it, Quist is 100% now on board. She needs to be fired.
Yeah, well.
Because she was a security risk because of the affair.
Yeah.
She didn't divulge that information. She was keeping secrets, and, you know, that ultimately turned out to be germane. So I thought that was interesting. But, of course, what he was able to point out was that he had the file, and he was able to point out to the minister that the part about her having the affair wasn't in the computer file. He had not figured that out. And that was the reason she was a security risk, not her heritage. And
correct.
So, therefore, you know, why did they do it? Well, the cop guy working on it had made an intuitive decision that was happening. And so in the end, Ridge, you know, put it on him. He said, fine, then you make the decision as to whether or not Toby Wren, not the computer, you use your cop intuition and you decide whether Toby Wren is a security risk or not. And of course, he's returned to work because he's not. He never got anything out of him, drunk or sober. But, you know, I mean, obviously Quist is right there too. I mean, you know, I think it's a hard decision, but I think he probably did make the right decision in that day and age. As we kind of mentioned earlier, it may, whether or not what she was doing is her own business is not really the issue. The issue is it could potentially compromise the security of her work.
True, and I there is a certain accuracy. I'm not saying that the judgment is right, but there at least there's an honesty in that portrayal. I mean, I used to work for the Department of Energy back when I lived in California, and that was still at a time where there was a social stigma against gays having any kind of high-level clearance, be it in science or government or both. And if it were revealed that you are of that persuasion, it could cost you your job, because it was viewed by people who claim to be experts that by being this way, that you could easily be bought, coerced.
Are you saying then that during your time at the Energy Commission you were closeted?
Big time.
Well, then I think that proves their point. I mean, you know, it is a vicious circle. Somebody could out you, and then you'd lose your job. And so, therefore, it's a self-perpetuating loop. It's that snake eating its own tail.
It was the only way I could keep my job. Well, I was more than just closet. I mean, I was a I was a model citizen. I mean, I in terms of my behavior,
I impregnated 40 women.
I mean, now please. I lived. I don't want to go too deep.
You had the big macho mustache that they had
back
then.
No, oh good heavens, no, no, please. That would have been a screaming giveaway.
See, now the funny thing is that from, you know, although I never found it appealing. You know, I mean, back in the 70s, guys with those mustaches were supposed to be being portrayed as masculine.
I never liked it.
Well,
but that's another subject.
Like Burt Reynolds. I mean, seriously.
That's a completely different subject. My point is that was I closeted? Yes. But at the same time, I was quite the model citizen. I mean, I didn't go out. I didn't socialize. And anytime I did socialize, it was with church groups. So I was projecting this image of someone who was a devout conservative Christian. Yeah, which is quite the departure from what I really am. But at the same time, I mean, that's the way society really was. And it's you're right. It is the snake eating its tail. I mean, it's kind of self-perpetuating. But I wasn't the one who was ready to take up the cause and say what you're doing here is wrong. I mean, I was more concerned about I need to make a paycheck. I need to earn money. I need to make a living. So I played ball, so to speak. But that kind of thing did exist for the longest time. Even in other forms of government, I heard about people who were outed working as part of the Secret Service, and they were immediately fired because they were considered, by virtue of being gay, that they were a security risk. So to see the fact that Stella, who, while it is her own personal life and her personal life.
But isn't that the argument for any sort of sexual?
Yes, it is.
I don't want to say deviancy, but you know what I mean.
I know what you mean. But that's the way society
Help me with a word that's better than deviancy there.
Can't think
proclivities.
Of one. Okay, proclivities. That's a good one. I was going to say personal life. I mean, the personal life and the professional life can be, you know, the way a person conducts himself at home can have absolutely no bearing on how he conducts himself with his job.
But you know that when the stakes are high enough, someone, and that's the issue. I mean, that's the issue with security services, is that the people who are working against you will not honor that barrier between personal life and work life. If, you know, if they want to go after you and kill your wife and kids or threaten them to blackmail you to get the information, they will.
That was the very point I was just about to make.
So
that it really doesn't matter.
Right. I mean, they'll
in terms of a personal life. I mean, you could be, as I just described, you could be the model citizen. You could be the most honest, tax-paying husband with a wife, you know, a loving family situation. And in some ways, if that got out, that's an even bigger security risk because an enemy might see that. They could say, okay, well, this person, he really loves his wife. He really loves his children. Let's exploit it.
I wonder why that isn't – I mean, obviously that is an area of blackmail, but I mean – that is not the typical blackmail because, then they can just put you under protection and they can, once they're alerted to the threat, you can take precautions. But with something that they're revealing a secret about you, then they can just hold that over you forever kind of thing. You'd think they could hold the other over, but, you know, you could just pack up and leave and say, to hell with it, I'm taking my family to Hawaii and...
But the point that I think that really, again, needs to be delivered is that there was this error in thinking that just because a person is having a secret clandestine affair, that makes them a greater security risk than someone who isn't, when it could have absolutely no bearing at all in terms of how they conduct themselves in their professional life.
Well, this is amazing. I mean, last week on Fusion Patrol, we solved the nature of time in Doctor Who, and this week we have solved the problems of the 1970s. We are on a roll here, I have to say. Final word. What do you think? What did you think of the episode?
No, as I said earlier, it was a fun episode. I enjoyed it. Not very sci-fi in nature, but it was fun, especially regarding how humans, people in some kind of maybe government power, you know, how they're turning over too much judgmental power and ability to computers. Just surrendering it, as you said earlier, abrogating that kind of responsibility. Not a very heavy sci-fi, but enjoyable nonetheless. You know, because one of the things that's really fun about science fiction is that it can spur interesting conversation, and this episode did that.
And I found it a disturbing episode. I enjoyed the episode, but I really, it's so old that when I look at it and I look at that, the cautions and the warnings that they were worried about even back then about data collection and decisions based on that data, that the episode was so oddly prescient that I look at the world we live in today and realize that
there's no real privacy.
There is no real privacy, and that sometimes, you know, it isn't all about science fiction popping up and saying, yes, in 30 years we'll be flying with jetpacks. Sometimes they really have nailed on to something that we should have been paying attention to for the last 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
Literally. So, I'll give it a thumbs up on the episode.
I would agree with that.
Next time, we are back to Man from Atlantis.
I was afraid you were going to say
that. I'm going to say that. I think we've got one of the best episodes ever in terms of being awful.
Oh, no. Not that episode.
Are
you still holding that in reserve?
I'm still holding that in reserve. I do actually. I think I may have told a fib and said we were only going to do two more episodes of Man from Atlantis, but I realized that we really, really need to do three episodes, and that's C.W. Hyde, The Imp, and the final episode, which I can't think of its name right now, but it's the one with the midget. That's best I can say. It's got the midget, and it's got the guy who can shoot electrical current through his fake hand at the carnival.
Oh, dear God.
So, but I think I want to talk about C.W. Hyde next time. And so we hope you'll join us, because even though it's a terrible, terrible episode, we're going to have a lot of fun with it.
Oh. I can only hope, because I just know I'm just going to be shaking my head as I'm watching this, tears coming out of my eyes, like, why am I being tortured?
I'm hoping that you will be as incensed by this one as you were by The Naked Montague.
Oh, God, I hope not. No episode in history ever made me so angry as that one did.
Well, this one should.
Okay, I guess forewarned is forearmed.
Forewarned is fine. It's not a spoiler. It's a warning. There's a difference between spoilers and warnings. One is to prevent you. You know, a spoiler is like the thing on the back of a car that blows the air away,
and a warning is like the
cattle guard up front.
I understand. This was not a spoiler. It was a warning. Does that make me feel any better? Not in the slightest.
Kind of makes me feel better. Now I know you're worried about it.
It's not a question of worry. It's more dread.
Dread? I would use dread, worry is somewhat interchangeable. Anyway, so join us again next time on Fusion Patrol.
Not so cheers.
You've been listening to the Fusion Patrol podcast, a production of Lone Locust Productions. Join us on our new discussion forums at FusionPatrol.com. Find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter, username Fusion Patrol. You can also send us feedback by email at feedback@FusionPatrol.com. If you'd like to support Fusion Patrol, please leave us a review on iTunes. Fusion Patrol's theme music is Fight the Future by Amber Wolf.